The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Is this Scorpions? Come on now, G, playing a little bit of the German stuff. I think it's trying to get us in the mood for what's going on there in the eastern part of Europe with Ukraine. We'll talk about that after our special guest, who's now in studio, not on the VIP line, but in studio. He's the district attorney for the awesomest judicial district in the state of Colorado, 1.1 plus million Coloradans. And for those of you doing math at home, that is more than one in six Coloradans call the 18th home. I know it a little bit, been there before, seen it, live in it, all that other stuff. But to help us understand some nuttiness that is going on under the Gold Dome, John Kellner. John, thanks for joining us in studio.
Thanks again for having me, George.
Oh, hang on.
Thanks again for having me, George.
Yeah, you're all dressed up like you're actually going to work today. I mean, this is not how we normally, you know, I'm in sweats. I look like I could be going back under a viaduct to catch a nap after this. You look like you're actually going to court.
That's because I am actually going to work after this.
Oh.
It's nice to see what life after being the district attorney looks like. It looks very comfortable.
A lot of sweats, man. Although you don't get to wear them in the AG's office. My understanding is that they have a dress code there. You can obviously change it. I just presume you will stick with pants.
Yeah, pants and a shirt and a tie.
Shirt and a tie, maybe a jacket.
Yeah.
And some personal hygiene. Well, I'll be looking forward to that. A year from now, we will do another interview and see if you're dressed the same way. But there was something that you and I offline had been chatting about, and there is a bill. Is it in the judiciary today or was it yesterday?
Which bill are we talking about, George? There's a lot.
I know, there's a lot. And I want you to talk about the ones that bug you the most, but there's that one about, and it's called like raise the bar or allow young kids to commit crimes without consequences, or what's it called?
Yeah, it's the second one.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's in the judiciary, I believe, today.
Okay.
For action only. It's not taking testimony because I already actually took,
oh boy,
I want to say 5 hours of testimony on that bill. And that's a very concerning one for us in the criminal justice system. Colorado District Attorney's Council is actually united in opposition.
Hold on,
to that
united
bill.
Like including Denver and Jeffco and
all 22 district attorneys, and you know how hard that is, right? So
in this day and age, impossible.
Yeah, and what that particular bill does, and there are some amendments I'm told are coming down the line here, but what it does right now is it actually decriminalizes everything but homicide for crimes committed by juveniles between the ages of 10 and, you know, up to 13. Now, the problem with that, it sounds good on paper. You know, you hear that and you think, look, we don't want to charge kids with crimes. You know, we don't. We actually would like to see everybody get along and never have any victims. But the reality is that we see a lot of cases. I think there was upwards of 80 sexual assaults by juveniles against other juveniles that would fit in this age range that we filed in our office over the last 5 years. And, you know, there has to be some mechanism for victims to obtain justice, for there to be accountability for juveniles, and not in the punishment sense particularly, because in the juvenile justice system, we're aiming towards rehabilitation, right? It's not about locking kids up and throwing away. It's about making sure we get some resources for victims and for offenders so they don't commit these crimes again.
When you look at this, and I think some people here for the first time are like, oh my God, we can charge 11-year-olds with crimes and 12-year-olds with crimes. That part is true, and for the reasons you pointed out. But if this bill became law without whatever amendments that they're talking about now because it's a dumpster fire of a bill, what then would be the consequences for a 12-year-old sexual assaulter of a younger person or even someone their same age?
Well, that's one of the fatal flaws of the bill as we see it in the District Attorney's Council, and I see it personally, is that there's not actually something else to backfill providing those resources or services.
Wait a minute, so you just get grounded? That's it? I mean, you're grounded? Please don't digitally penetrate your young cousin anymore and go back to school?
You know, you hate to joke about things like that.
I'm not joking. That happens, as you know. That thing happens all the time.
Exactly. There is not a system in place. They have a vision to create a task force to talk about what system might go in that place.
Yeah.
But there's nothing for right now. All right. So there's this constant rush to see at the legislature to have certain legislators put their mark on our statutes and, you know, perhaps appease some of their interest groups to help them get elected. Mm-hmm. You know, this particular bill, I think, falls into that category, running too fast, too hard, and leaving a lot of gaps when it comes to public safety.
I think one of the other things people don't appreciate about our juvenile justice system is we are so focused on the rehabilitative aspects of it. In fact, that is the priority under mm-hmm. the statute, that we use different terms. We don't call them defendants. We don't call them convictions. And I think one thing that you should talk to folks about is, one, we're not talking about charging these kids as adults, and then at the end of the day, they go into big boy prison or even a young person's prison. Talk about that system that exists that allows us to convince them, if not coerce them, into rehabilitation that we wouldn't have in the absence of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to recognize the primary purpose of the juvenile justice system is not punishment, right? It is rehabilitation. It's trying to make sure kids get back on the right path. And sometimes that's, you know, providing resources to children, but also to their parents, right, who need help as well. Counseling services that might not be covered necessarily by insurance, for instance. And really what I am concerned about with this bill and the way it's drafted is, let's talk about juveniles with guns. What happens when a 12-year-old brings a gun to school? Because, you know, we've seen that, yeah. Right? And we've seen it, sadly, in many ways with other juveniles, too. But and what's the consequence for that? There's got to be some
mechanism. To be clear, this law exempts one crime,
yeah,
and that is murder.
Yeah.
So under this law, if it passes, if a 12-year-old brings a gun to school and shoots somebody's kid or grandkid, but they don't die, they're just maimed, maybe they're paralyzed, maybe they have to wear a colostomy bag for the rest of their lives, what would the consequences be for the 12-year-old shooter?
We don't know. It's not going to be in the justice system because it essentially immunizes them entirely. You know, it takes prosecutors, it takes law enforcement out of that equation entirely. So unless there's all of a sudden going to be new resources provided that are ensuring accountability, which, you know, it's not always voluntary, right? As you mentioned earlier,
needs to not be voluntary for a whole bunch of people.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. To get the outcome that we all want, which is, hey, this person has been rehabilitated and is a law abiding citizen moving forward.
Where's the attorney general on this? And I say, ask that in the context of you're running for attorney general. There's a guy in there already who has less than no experience in criminal justice. Where is he on this issue? Is he outspoken?
You know, I haven't seen or heard what he has to say about this, if anything. You know, obviously, I'm focused as the district attorney
sure.
right in front of me on what the consequences are for the people in our community and our judicial district. So I haven't looked at what he's saying, but if he's saying something, it's not very loud.
Yeah, he's whispering it. And that's not the first time, by the way, and we'll talk about some of these other things. Let me just go back to this, because when you talk about removing some of the mandated rehabilitation and treatment, the legislature has been doing this across the board. And one of the other things they've done was to, a couple years ago, in essence, decriminalize the possession of a whole host of drugs, including fentanyl. Mm-hmm. Like, you can carry around right now enough fentanyl to kill 2,000 people, and it's treated like a traffic ticket in many ways. And when they did that, they killed what were otherwise fantastically successful programs that you, like, there's drug courts, there's diversion, there's all of these things where we're not looking to incarcerate drug addicts, we're not looking to felonize them, we're looking to put them in a position where they have to be better, they have to get better. When you take that away, what's the backfill for that?
Well, I think we're seeing the consequences of that right now. We're seeing increased overdose deaths. We're seeing people that are not taking advantage of treatment resources. They're not getting into treatment because they're getting that ticket that says, hey, show up to court in a couple months. And in that meantime, they're going on to likely use a lot more drugs, potentially overdose and die, or commit other crimes to feed that addiction. Right? We used to have a mechanism to say, look, this is serious and you need to take it seriously. There's a potential for a felony conviction. But you remember back in the day, what we had was a wobbler, which
yeah,
is
yeah, we did, which was also a huge transition from what we had before.
Right. And what that said was, look, if you complete that treatment, if you actually accomplish yep. the goal of getting clean, which we are all on board with supporting, then, hey, guess what? That felony becomes a misdemeanor.
Automatically.
Congratulations. We are proud of you.
Yep.
Hey, don't do it again. And, you know, here's that sort of resources treatment resources that are going to continue on with you as well, because you don't just necessarily, you know, pull the ripcord and say
yeah,
goodbye.
Yeah.
They develop support systems around defendants. And I think we've lost focus of the idea that there needs to be both a carrot and a stick to ensure compliance here. And especially with a drug as powerful as fentanyl, one that is as addictive as fentanyl, we're going to need sometimes a kick in the butt for people to help get them into that treatment.
And anything we can do to discourage or deter those who would otherwise distribute something that has fentanyl in it. And we've taken that away, too. Now, this has become a very hot button issue. It seems to be the only part of the criminal justice system where you can get those on the left and in power to say, yes, we should treat them more harshly. Going back to that 2019 bill that the governor signed into law saying, yes, let's treat fentanyl like it's speeding. Where was the AG on that?
Silent. You know, certainly not leading from the front. You know, we had district attorneys out there testifying about how this was bad and even asking to exempt fentanyl, you know, from this. And look, you know, going back a few years, George, you and I both remember this case involving a woman named Almeda Sullivan in our jurisdiction, right?
Yeah, we did.
Who was distributing, you know, opioid pills to
Opana.
Young people,
Opana,
causing overdoses. And we aggressively prosecuted that woman for murder. Remember
That's
that?
That's right. I do.
And when that case was over, and we talked to surviving family members, and we said, hey, you know, we ought to have a sentence enhancer for drug dealers that cause death like
Absolutely.
This. And we went to the legislature. You know, Senator John Cook introduced this bill saying, hey, we would like to have a sentence enhancer. This is 2016, mind you. 2016. Saying we want a sentence enhancer for drug distribution causing death. And that died in committee. I think it was postponed indefinitely, which is a polite way of saying it was killed.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, years later, at crisis point, right? Now we have people like the governor and the attorney general saying, you know what might be good? We ought to have a sentence enhancer for drug distributors that cause death. You know, it's a day late and a dollar short. That is leading from behind.
I've seen Phil now recently on social media saying, hey, it's a no-brainer. We really got it. It's like, well, if it's such a no-brainer, dude, where were you 2 years ago when this was happening? But there's another portion of that bill that you've, and by the way, my hat's off to you. You have taken a real leadership role, even, and I'm not going to say against, but even a different pace and direction than the whole CDAC, than the whole District Attorney's Council on some things. But there's another thing that with that bill that sort of decriminalized all the drugs. There's another bill where we turned a whole bunch of things into misdemeanors, and we did misdemeanor reform bill. But then in that quote-unquote misdemeanor reform bill, the legislature came in and said, shh, we're going to change something about a felony involving guns. What was that?
Yeah, that's a big one. So this misdemeanor reform bill that passed last year was over 300 pages long. And it was primarily all about misdemeanors, but sort of tucked in there somewhere was a change to a law called possession of a weapon by a previous offender. That's PAWPO, what we call it in law enforcement. And what it says is, look, if you've been convicted of a felony, which is hard to do in the state of Colorado, we don't just hand out felonies to everybody.
It's hard.
Yeah.
It's hard to get convicted of a felony.
Yeah. But if you are convicted of a felony, you may not possess a firearm after that. And look, you can't lawfully pass a background check at that point either to purchase that firearm. And so that law was on the books, and they made a big change inside the misdemeanor reform bill.
The one they didn't advertise in their press release or anything like that.
No. Look, there's some good about it. What it did was it said, hey, we're going to make this from a class 6 felony to a class 5. I'm on board with that.
Yeah, great.
It also said, hey, look, if you use that gun and you're a previously convicted felon in the course of another crime, probation is no longer on the table.
Boom.
That's another great thing that we've been advocating for. But then they also neutered PAWPO as well. And they limited to only apply to about 50 felonies, and there's about 600. So really, it completely minimized the scope of application. So what it enabled as of March 1st of this year when it went into effect is those fentanyl drug dealers, you might have been convicted of a felony offense of distributing fentanyl, but guess what? It's no longer a crime under that bill, that misdemeanor reform bill that passed, for them to possess a firearm under state law.
There's also no connection at all between drug dealing and firearms. That's just a Hollywood myth.
You know, another one is
aggravated motor vehicle theft.
That one drives me nuts because, you know, not too long ago, here in September of last year, we had a police officer who was shot 8 times by a person who was PAWPO. And you know, that person would no longer qualify for being PAWPO for that crime. And what I think people miss out on is having the PAWPO statute is a way for us to not only solve crimes, but it's a way for us to disrupt future violent crime by taking guns out of the hands of people who've shown, hey, you are not a law-abiding citizen. You've committed a very serious offense, and you cannot be trusted at this point to carry that firearm around. who've shown a propensity in many respects for, you know, committing very serious offenses. And law enforcement, I think, is seeing this right now, and they are standing up saying, whoa, 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 we need to change this. I've been testifying about that.
Absolutely. What else is out? I should have gone back. I'm sorry I left the fentanyl thing. My guess is the fact that the governor referenced it in his State of the State address, the fact that the AG is now desperately trying to look both active and strong on criminal justice and has lit social media up with all this fentanyl stuff. My guess is we have a bill that's been introduced and is on its way to the governor's desk right now.
You'd be wrong on that guess.
Shocked.
No, it's not been introduced. I know that there are people working on that. You know, we keep hearing that the speaker is working on pulling together stakeholders to introduce a bill.
Stakeholders like the DAs?
Well, I know DAs are involved in that discussion.
Which DAs?
Well, a number of us. I mean, we had, prior to the session starting, you know, we had been saying, look, we need to right-size these statutes because they do not align with the weights of fentanyl and the seriousness associated with it, saying, hey, look, we need to change this distribution level. My understanding right now, there's quite a bit of disagreement among the Democrat caucus about possession, right, and whether or not that should be a felony again.
Good Lord.
Or if it should be 4 grams. And
you know, that's 2,000 deaths.
it is incredible to think about. You know, it could easily be 40-plus pills, right? And that is a misdemeanor. And, you know, really the law says, hey, we think this is a user amount. That is not amount.
Unless you're killing yourself.
Or others around you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. What else is going on in the legislature in the minute or so that we have left? What are the other things that you're focused on trying to get done? I mean, we know the great work you do as the DA, and we see all that stuff. But I don't think people appreciate how much time you have to spend trying to make sure that the tools that you use for public safety and justice aren't taken away.
Yeah, I mean, on some positive things, we've looked at expanding the Victims' Rights Act, and we've actually got a lot of traction on that. That's moved forward really well. You know, we've got things like intimidating a witness, a bill that's actually going to the governor's desk that we supported. So there are some things working on a positive note. But, man, we've got to fix this thing with felons possessing guns. We've got to fix this fentanyl issue, get these things right-sized so that we can hold dealers accountable and help get addicts into treatment.
Listen, I know you're running for attorney general. Let's just presume that you get elected because you're going to get elected. As attorney general, do you plan on playing a more active role on criminal justice issues at the legislature and elsewhere, or just show up during a reelection year to announce, hey, all the things you were quiet on, you actually don't support anymore?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the attorney general has to be a leader when it comes to public safety, standing up for victims and our communities, being a voice from that bully pulpit and saying, look, you know, this is not good for the state of Colorado. And that's something that the attorney general has failed at doing. I'm going to lead from the front when it comes to this because I've got the experience and the knowledge on how to do it.
He does show a willingness to file amicus briefs on behalf of other states to allow open injection sites. Will you do that?
Absolutely not.
How can folks get in touch with you or learn more about you?
Hey, go to johnkellner.com, johnkellner.com.
John Kellner, he'll be back on, man. We have to have conversations about the criminal justice stuff. It's not going anywhere. When we come back, your calls, another topic, 303-696-1971, George Brockler, 710 KNUS. Hey, my great thanks to District Attorney for the 18th Judicial District, the mighty fighting 18th, John Kellner, for being in studio with us today. It was good to have him here instead of on the phone, talking up all the things going on in the legislature. Some real causes for concern there, and don't let the other side flip the switch and try to tell you they're for something that they're not. These people aren't delaying a fentanyl fix bill because they're trying to figure out how can we lock up these dealers of poison and death. No, they're trying to figure out how can we do something, look like we've done something, say we're tough on crime, but not actually ever have one more person spend one more minute incarcerated. That's really how it works. I mean, one of the things I think I heard the attorney general say at one point was, we need to have stiffer sentences. He maybe even said mandatory sentences for those people who knowingly distribute fentanyl that leads to the death of another person. Now, as you heard John say, that was something that we pitched back in 2016, and the Dems couldn't have run further away from it. But now all of a sudden it seems like a good idea. But I tell you, that language for a bill makes it impossible to prosecute. I mean, short of you finding some numbskull drug dealer, one, tracing it back to a drug dealer is incredibly hard. But knowing that they have whatever pills may have been led to this thing, when they're getting questioned, you think they're going to say, absolutely, I knew it had fentanyl in it. And that's why I saw. They're not going to say that. The ability. And we had on Dave Oleski from DEA on here to talk about that. Short of there being a wire or something or someone undercover that could talk, how in the heck is a prosecutor ever going to prove that? That's one of those empty bills, those fake bills, kind of like the you can't ballot harvest, you can't turn in more than 10 ballots. That sounds super cool and like it's super protective. Unenforceable. That's not just me saying it. That's the chief of the elections thing out at the Secretary of State's office, Judd Choate, he said the same thing. So don't let them get you thinking and don't let other people say, hey, I think they're really taking the right steps until you see the bill, because a lot of this stuff is just silliness. Now, look, we have on the phone with us, not on the John Kellner criminal justice stuff, but someone else. They are from Florida. Tom, are you really from Florida?
No, but I live here now.
Okay, what are you doing? What part of Florida?
Orlando area.
Buddy, do you work at one of the amusement parks?
No.
And everyone that says that, because it's Orlando. I was just there. It's great out there. And thank you for listening from all the way in Orlando. You had some thoughts or you wanted to share with us?
Yes, I did. And if Pete's, I don't know if Pete listens to your show while he's driving home or not. But
probably for the first minute.
I would have called him directly, if not for the fact that I had already called this week. But I just wanted to pass on to you,
yeah, please.
My historic understanding is that you are 100% correct, and I was yelling at the radio the entire time when Pete was bringing this up. As you know, as a lawyer, a lot of times the raw facts are not in dispute. It's the interpretation of them. And you're 100% correct. Pete was reading an editorial opinion about certain documents and not the original source documents themselves. If we go back and remember, I believe those comments were made within the context of German unification.
And that's at least what the Gorbachev thing that I read. I'm just going to presume it's legit. It's not a made-up interview. That's what he says, too, is that, look, this was all about the former GDR. This was not about expanding it anywhere else into Eastern Europe. Even after the Warsaw exactly. Pact, he said it didn't have anything to do with that.
No, and Putin had a rather hostile interview with a reporter. I forget where the reporter came from. Had an American accent. But Putin mentioned the fact that they had received assurances. And the reporter asked Putin, where is that documented? And Putin admitted that he didn't have any documentation.
Now, oh, he did? He admitted that there's no documentation?
Yeah. Well, he admitted by just smiling and not answering the question.
Okay. We could call that some sort of an admission by not objecting, but I'd like to see something more.
If you saw the interview, he was obviously admitting it. That they did not have anything in writing.
I think the other thing, too, though, is, and the reason the documents are important, and I'm going to try to spend some time when I get actual paid work done here today to take a look at what Pete's referencing, because, you know, Pete's no dummy. He's about as well-read and smart a guy as you're going to get on the radio, and it does concern me that there's this conflict in what the facts are, not even how to interpret them, but what the facts are. So I want to find those source documents. But it's just interesting to me that the guy who was at the table back in 2014 when this whole invasion of Crimea takes place by Russia, that's when he's interviewed about it. And he says, no, there wasn't anything like that. No Eastern country brought it up. We didn't bring it up. That feels pretty definitive. But I want to look at the other documents.
You have to remember, too, that the Germanys had not unified yet. And it was not imposed on them. They were two sovereign countries, and those negotiations still had to take place. Now, East Germany was deathly afraid of losing subsidies from Moscow because their economy was in shambles, and their mark was in terrible shape. Now, they were looking at something more like a federation, and to support that, the fact that East Germany would not become part of NATO or be militarized, but West Germany would, kind of substantiates my idea that they were everybody kind of thought that they were negotiating for a federation between the two with some limited sovereignty. Now, West Germany came along and pulled a move that nobody expected. They made East Germany a deal that they couldn't refuse. They absorbed all of East Germany's debt. Which was a tremendous thing, and East Germany just simply...
It also sounds like, at least according to Gorbachev, that whatever reunification took place, that path, they still adhered to the deal, that they wouldn't put NATO military infrastructure in East Germany. And at least back in 2014, I know that's 8 years ago, he said, and that has been adhered to, even to this day. Those were his words. It's like, well, what do you do with that?
Yeah, you got to remember, the East Germans, unlike many of the other East European satellites, the East Germans were hardcore communists. These guys did not see themselves as under the boot of the Soviets. They were full partners.
Huh, interesting.
And that was, again, they did not expect West Germany to make the offer.
Oh, and if you saw some of the Olympics back in the day, that may have been the first time that women took testosterone treatments to try to be better. I don't know if you ever saw some of those East European. That was the running joke, was that the East European women/men were going to dominate in this event or the next. Let me ask you this, too. Do you find that the agreement in 1994, and I'm going to go back and figure out if that was Yeltsin or someone else, but that agreement signed by the
U.S. 94 would have been Yeltsin.
Okay, so Yeltsin. And that's that Budapest memorandum that really, and I read it on the radio, I think a few days ago or maybe last week, spells out pretty unequivocally that Russia agrees to defend and support the integrity of Ukraine and their sovereignty. So I don't know how you get to do that and then say, but in 91, I don't understand.
Let me play devil's advocate here. The way Putin would be reading that is that that's exactly what they are doing. He sees 2014 as a Western coup d'etat. And therefore, by moving in, he is actually...
I mean, 2014, you're talking about when he took over Crimea?
No, the Orange Revolution. What was that, 2008 then?
Yeah, that's right. It would be back in the... Yeah, in that part of... I don't know if it's 2008, but it was definitely in that decade.
Yeah, he's reading it. Now, remember, this guy's a KGB guy. And I've read several biographies and heard him interviewed and all that kind of stuff. He knows that these things like the color revolutions, they don't just spring up out of the dirt. He knows very well, and I believe he's right, that all those kind of things, I mean, even the disruptions here in the United States, that takes coordination, that takes communication, it takes planning, organization, and money. They don't just happen, and they invented the game. So
well, and you cannot believe the dude either. When you get to 2014 and he denies any Russian involvement, and they talk about the little green men, and then years later he was like, "Okay, you got me. It was us. Whatever." You can't trust that guy. There's not a single word that comes out of his mouth. If he said it was daytime, you'd have to go look for yourself, because the dude is a trained and born liar. Let me ask you this time, with the short period of time we have left before I have to punch out, how does this thing end?
Not well. Not well. You don't want to hear my predicted scenario.
You absolutely know I do, because I asked the question.
Well, okay.
You got to give it to us in 20 seconds.
All right. The way it's ramping up, I think somebody wants a war, obviously. I mean,
who's that somebody?
Poland to be sending jets in, for Germany to be violating their own constitution and be sending javelins in. This is ramping up.
Tom, I hope it doesn't, but here's how it gets solved. And Tom, great phone call. Thank you for listening from Florida. They're sending Kamala Harris. Problem solved. Boom. She is going to do for Ukraine what she's done for the southern border. When we come back, we'll shift gears a little bit more, talk about a different topic that I wrote on. Until that time, you're listening to me, George Brockler, on the George Brockler Show. This here is the Mighty 710 KNUS. George Brockler back with you here till the top of the hour. Charlie Kirk thereafter, and then we go live and local at 3 o'clock with Stephen Tubbs. Pete back in the saddle tomorrow morning from 5 to 9, and then you get to hear me all over again. Before I talk to you about this next and last topic of the day, I want to remind you about some great folks, small business owners, and that is the backbone of this here Colorado and American economy, and we need to do everything we can to help them out. And in this case, it's actually better for you to go to them, and that is Littleton Jewelry out there just south of Hudson Gardens on the west side of 85. That's Santa Fe. Go north if you're from my part of town, and you flip a little U-turn legal at Hudson Gardens, and then take your next right when you head down. If you're coming down south, easy peasy. You just drive down right past Hudson Gardens and turn right. You get into there. They're expanding, by the way. So if you look at one side of the place that they're in, you can see that they're getting bigger. They're renovating it. Man, maybe there's going to be some, I don't know if there's going to be like a grand opening thing. I'll reach out to Jesse. And Jesse's who owns and runs this. He took it over from his parents when it was just a watch repair place and has since really blown it up and taken it to the next level. They do everything related to jewelry, including buying gold and silver. And you should know that at least according to the interwebs here, gold is at about $2,004 an ounce. Dang! Take yours in there, get it appraised, see what you can sell it for. Maybe you want to buy some, or maybe you just want to take some of your gold jewelry, silver jewelry, and go have it changed, fix up, whatever it is, that's the place to go. Jesse's team is a bunch of homegrown folks. They all grew up here in Colorado, I think in the area. The one guy I want to hook up with is their custom design jewelry guy. He just wasn't in the day that I was in there. I just got to get back out there. But you can trust these folks to do great work. Everybody I saw in there as a customer, they knew on site. They tended to them, took care of their needs. And I think that's what Jesse told me is, look, this is all just about customer service. I mean, we do great work, but without the customer service piece, it doesn't matter. And they focus on that. So here's the deal. You go visit them, stop by, bring something that they can fix or clean up or whatever. You're going to be happy that you did. Maybe you'll walk out of there with something new. Who knows? If you can't get to them today, and it is cold out there, peeps. 22 degrees is supposed to be the high with this intermittent snow and stuff, which I can see blowing right outside the palatial offices of 710 KNUS. You can also find them online. Look them up at littletonfinejewelry.com. That's littletonfinejewelry.com. And when you get there, please, pretty please, with a little 710 on top, can you tell them George sent you there? Now, there's a scandal that's taken place in Colorado. You wouldn't know it because it was just barely reported enough that the mainstream media can say, hey, we covered part of this thing. But I turned it into a column that got published over the weekend in the Denver Post, and you should go online and look it up. In fact, it's on our website right now. Click on it, read it, share it. The more clicks, by the way, the better, because that's how the Denver Post knows that conservative views matter to their paper and their editorial pages. And they title it, I don't, and it says, Brockler, colon, it's always tough to hear your colon after Brockler, but Brockler, colon, audit the $90 million no-bid contract for faulty COVID tests. Pay attention to this and tell me if you've ever heard this anywhere else and what you think ought to take place. All right, this is craziness. Oh, boy. And, of course, being the superstar that I am, when you hit print, somehow you lose out on the bottom of the page. Sweet mother of goodness. Bear with me 1 second while I find this thing, because as it turns out... I've printed off all the pages after the first one, and that's pretty awesome for me to have done that right there. Oh, golly, geez. How did I end up doing that? I think it starts off with, forgive me, that between November and January, November 2020 and January 2021, we lost 1,118 Coloradans in nursing home deaths related to COVID. That is an epic number. Not only is it an epic number, but between Thanksgiving and Christmas of that 2020, that number represented 200% of the national average. It was the killing fields for us. And how we got there matters. And so in this particular case, and I'll pick up from right here. It says those nursing homes had been provided with faulty COVID tests from a $90 million no-bid contract given to a startup company funded by someone who contributed to Governor Jared Polis' political campaign. Last month, Democrats on the Legislative Audit Committee refused to permit even a discussion of an investigation into that scandalous and deadly situation. They want it to remain swept under the rug. That's, and this is off topic, I mean, off editorial here. That's 1,118 Coloradans who died because of the COVID and these faulty tests. Now, these tests were giving false positives. And the reason the way the Dems were able to kill it is the audit committee is a 4-4. It takes five votes, four Republicans, four Ds. It takes five votes to get something to be audited. We'll talk about that in a second. And this is when I say I'm willing to bet you've heard more about opt-in plasticware at restaurants than you have about this scandal. Here's the background. The rate of nursing home bed deaths in our state from Thanksgiving to Christmas 2020, as reported by Ben Marcus from Colorado Public Radio, was double the national average. Our nursing homes became COVID killing fields unparalleled in all of America. That's the worst, right? Did you know that? Did you know that for a time we had more dead people per capita? The rate of death was more in Colorado than anywhere else? No. Other than Ben Marcus, one possible reason for the runaway number of deaths as uncovered by Marcus in his investigation was the complete failure of the testing system adopted by Polis Health Department. Shortly after Colorado and the world were beset by the pandemic, Polis appointed Casey Wolf, now with the Biden administration, his handpicked senior advisor for COVID-19 response, to secure reliable COVID testing for the most vulnerable Coloradans. Gary Lauder of the Estee Lauder cosmetic dynasty was an investor on a COVID-19 startup called Curative. Curative, by the way, he was also a decade-long friend and supporter of Polis. Curative was run by a 25-year-old college dropout. Over the weekend of July 11th, 2020, emails obtained by the Colorado Springs Gazette showed that Lauder hosted Wolf and her husband for a weekend at his house. That's not sufficient enough to describe it. At a kajillion-dollar mansion in Aspen. That's where he housed them. And then it says at 8:31 p.m. on Sunday, July the 12th, shortly after Casey Wolf and her husband left the Lauder mansion, Lauder sent an email directly to the CEO of Curative, connecting him to Wolf and specifically referencing Colorado, quote, trying to augment its testing capacity. The following day, Curative CEO responded to Wolf, thanked Lauder and expressed Curative's interest in pursuing a relationship with Colorado on September the 4th, 2020, less than 3 months later, when the state's testing labs were unable to keep up with testing, Colorado awarded Curative a no-bid contract for $89 million lasting through March 31st, 2021. But the tests were untrustworthy. They sucked. On January the 4th, 2021, the Food and Drug Administration issued a safety alert, quote, alerting patients and healthcare providers of the risk of false results, particularly false negative results, end quote. It took Polis's CDPHE 17 more days to publicly announce that the state will no longer be using Curative testing. Despite the termination of the use of Curative tests more than 2 months early from that contract termination date, Curative still found a way to bill and collect from Colorado $89 million, nearly every penny, for a contract that was not supposed to expire until March 31st. There are myriad questions to be asked about how such a dumpster fire of governmental decision-making and mismanagement occurred, but Polis and his health department provided few answers to the public. Enter transparency and accountability seeker State Senator Rob Woodward from Larimer County. Woodward's made five requests to get the Legislative Audit Committee to look into a no-bid contract for faulty COVID tests, as well as a separate $56 million state contract to distribute 2 million rapid at-home tests, which were never distributed, even when there was a statewide shortage of rapid at-home tests during Omicron. That's nearly $150 million in wasted taxpayer monies. The audit committee, on a party line vote, chose to do nothing. Woodward's July 2021 urgent audit request was not brought up for hearing for 2 months. Then Democrats on the Legislative Audit Committee stalled on any vote, claiming that they needed more time to review the request. And then last month, 5 months after the urgent audit request was submitted, Democrat leaders of the audit committee quickly called up the request and voted to do nothing. In defending their decision to allow the truth to remain hidden from the public during an election year, State Representative Daphna Michelson-Janay summed up her opposition to the audit by quoting the head of the state's testing program, who testified that the failed decision-making was, quote, made on the best science and data available at the time. What? In voting to look no further into this outrageous matter, Michelson-Janay stated, I don't know that there's any more that can be done with continuing forward in this audit request. Come again? Colorado taxpayers spend $11 million per year to fund the 74 employees at the state auditor's office. If this is not the kind of issue for which they exist, then let's fold up the auditor's tent and stop pretending that they exist for transparency and accountability. In refusing to review these questionable and failed contracts, the See No Evil, Hear No Evil Democrats on the Legislative Audit Committee are participating in a cover-up of mismanagement by the Polis administration that could have contributed to the deaths of 1,118 of the most vulnerable Coloradans. There's still time for the committee to change its mind, and Coloradans should demand the legislature do just that. My recommendation to you is you reach out to whoever your elected representative is and ask them, why aren't you looking into this monstrous outcome? 1,100 deaths, $150 million in wasted money. You know, if there was a Republican governor in that, this would be on TV every day. It would be the focus of Next with Kyle Clark every single day. But apparently that's not going to happen here. Listen, I'll be back tomorrow with some guests. Stephen Tubbs at 3G Behind the Glass. Thanks for making it work out. My thanks to John Kellner for being in studio. Until next time, this is George Brockler on 710 KNUS.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.